Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And we've got a couple of returning guests on today's show. First up is my close friend, perhaps too close, my other half, Miss Emma Gerard.
Hi.
Here, what you should do is not talk. And also joining us today is the random husband figure who shows up somewhere in the middle, Mr. Eddie Tice.
Are you Alma for this podcast?
Yeah, you sure
okay.
I am.
All right.
On today's show, we're going to talk about the number 17 movie on the Sight and Sound Greatest of All Time list, Ingmar Bergman's experimental film Persona. Listen up to find out if all of us left this movie with all of our gray matter intact. Then we're going to follow that up with a discussion about Richard Linklater's new release, Boyhood. As listeners will recall, our lineup today is the same group as our recent Teen Movie-Thon series, where we inducted Linklater's film Dazed and Confused into the FlixWise Favorites list. Let's see how Boyhood stands up next to its older brother. Finally, we'll wrap up the show with our final notes of positivity. You guys ready? Anyone? The silence. Okay.
Carriage return.
For our first topic, we're going to discuss Ingmar Bergman's deeply unsettling exploration of the Scandinavian psyche, Persona. Released in 1966, Persona stars Liv Ullmann as Elizabeth Vogler, an actress who, for no apparent medical reason, has gone completely mute. Also starring in the film is Bibi Anderson as Alma, the nurse assigned to care for Elizabeth. The two ladies sojourn to a small beach house where Elizabeth can go swimming and pick wild mushrooms as she reconciles the loneliness and futility of existence. Meanwhile, Alma, while caring for Elizabeth, finds herself growing closer to her patient. Because of this closeness and because she wants to compensate for Elizabeth's silence, she ends up confessing all of her darkest secrets to her new friend. Unfortunately, Alma soon discovers that Elizabeth is not the trusted confidant that Alma thought she was. And I'm going to leave my description at that, and we'll get into the rest of the movie in our discussion. Let's do it. Okay, so, Andy, I'm going to start with you. What do you think of the movie? Did you like it?
I liked it a lot. This is the type of movie that keeps you guessing, and it always... One thing you want in a movie is supposed to make you want to see what's happening next. And this is exactly what happened in this movie. And I can't believe this was made in 1966. And the topics that were handled and the way they were handled is just amazing to me.
Yeah. You can get away with a lot more in Sweden, apparently.
Yes.
Emma, what do you think?
I agree that it was always having me want to know what was next. Like, I thought it was like a super thrilling story. It also helps that it looks really nice.
It does, yeah. Yes. I've heard it described as a horror film, and I think that's kind of true.
Yeah.
It was very scary, I think.
That's interesting because, you when you watch it, you don't think, hey, it's a horror film because it's not a traditional horror film, but it really is.
Yeah.
It handles the same themes that horror
exactly.
films do.
And I have to always remember that when I watch Bergman movies, that you think you're getting like a family melodrama and then everything just goes to hell. It's like, what am I watching?
Yeah.
but in film school, I had this like hardcore Bergman phase, and listeners will recall that Wild Strawberries is one of my favorite movies. And while this movie Persona is very different from Wild Strawberries, it still, I feel, has that trademark Bergman style, which I always feel so discombobulated after I watch one of his movies.
Sure.
The meaning of the movie, even the events of the movie, are not always super clear. Did you have a hard time following what was going on at all, Andy?
I didn't have a hard time following necessarily, but I always try to figure out. Do you guys always try to figure out, or do you just take the movie in, or are you trying to? I'm always trying to figure out what exactly, why is this happening when? So sometimes I was thinking, is this a dream part? And then when another scene would come along, I'd think, oh, that had to be a dream part, I think.
Yeah. I did a lot of that, yeah. Okay. But what do you think happened? What was happening in this movie? We should maybe go into... So I described sort of the beginning, the setup of the movie. But what is actually happening in this movie? Does anyone want to take that? Emma?
I mean, there's a couple of things happening. Elizabeth has an existential crisis, and she stops talking. And so there's her story of dealing with that and maybe recovering and maybe not. We don't really know. And then there's also Alma's story of being sort of sort of like assuming like a new identity and being like so wrapped in her like empathy for that she actually like starts losing her sense of self.
I think, yeah. Andy, did you have a similar interpretation of what happened?
I'm still, and I watched the end again, and I watched parts again, and I'm still torn whether Elizabeth is real or not.
Yeah, I had that same thought. I'm like, is this person in her mind?
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought, because she's an actress, I thought maybe Alma just sort of internalized her and was projecting an image of who she thinks this movie star is. And she actively wanted to become Elizabeth. So it wasn't so much that Elizabeth was being predatory or that this was a willful act of Alma's. She had made up this character who she could talk to and, you know, just converse with in this very one-sided way.
Yes. Yeah.
And, so I, especially at the end, I got to the impression that I wasn't sure exactly how much of the events of the movie are real and how much is just in Alma's head.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but then there's the kid. There's the beginning of the movie and the end of the movie, but it's bookended by that kid with glasses looking up at the screen. And I wondered if we could talk about what he's about.
Now, when you, this is my first time watching it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys remember the first time you watched it. I didn't notice that the images switched. Like, it was Alma, Elizabeth, because we weren't introduced to those people yet.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, you saw, oh, they're switching. So I actually went back to the beginning, and I looked, and I, oh, yeah, the image is switching. But at the time, my first viewing, I didn't notice.
I don't know. I mean... That the at the beginning when he's doing the flipping the single frame thing,
when he's putting his hand up, the images are switching between Alma and Elizabeth.
Mm.
But I didn't notice that because they and as they even said in the film, they look similar.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't know what this movie was about. I love to go to a movie and not know anything.
Yeah,
so
I didn't know that there were going to be two female leads.
Yeah. So, but what do you guys think Bergman was trying to say about identity and?
Well, I mean, it's a lot about sort of people. I think, in a way, people define their identities a lot by stories they see and hear and watch on movies and stuff.
Yeah.
So I think, like, that's kind of a theme in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're saying some people, what they see on TV or film or...
I think everyone kind of tries to make sense of their life by, like, making it into some kind of narrative. And I think a lot of, like, you know, our ideas of what a person is supposed to be and what our lives are supposed to be are, you know, shaped a lot by the stories that we tell each other, sure.
Sure, yeah. I see myself affected mostly by people you're closest to. And I guess that's reflected in this movie.
Yeah, I don't think it's exclusively about, you know, film and mm-hmm. characters on film either.
I think that's a part of it. I mean, he's very self-conscious about that he's talking about an actress and he's using the medium to make a point. It doesn't necessarily have to be exclusively about film. So, Andy, what was your takeaway? What did you think it was about?
Identity crisis,
mm-hmm.
definitely.
Yeah.
I loved some of the... I think if I would have seen this years ago, I wouldn't have caught some of the symbolism in it. You know, there's an obviously cracked statue at the end, a woman's face. It looked like the head of a ship. And I have a feeling Bergman just might have found that somewhere. I was like, oh, and mm-hmm. it's got a crack in its face. Let's put this in the front of the frame.
Yeah.
And then there's this great shot... after she drives, and she pulls over, and there's a pond, and there's there's her reflection in the pond, and it's just like, oh, and that's when it really, the symbolism really hit me, like, okay, this is where this is going.
Yeah.
And I was trying to make sense of black clothes, white clothes, and I didn't see anything specific there, but I thought I was trying to find something.
Yeah.
In, oh, now they're wearing black clothes, what does this mean? Mm. Now they're wearing white clothes, what does this mean?
I guess during anything? The tender moments between them, they're wearing white, and then when in the scene she's got the black bathing suit where she puts the glass on the ground, and when they have the and when Alma confronts her, she's wearing black. Yeah. So did you feel like, I don't know, we haven't really established whether or not Elizabeth is a real person. Mm-hmm. That's still kind of open to interpretation. But assuming that she was a real person, did you feel like her transferring her personality onto Alma was a predatory thing? Or was it something that Alma kind of welcomed?
I think it's a two-way street. Mm-hmm. Like, they're both shown to, like, have a lot of empathy. Like, if Elizabeth's real, her, you know, crisis comes very much out of distress about war and, you know, the suffering of, you know, children and other people. And then Alma's a nurse and she's a caretaker, and that puts her in the vulnerable position she ends up in. Mm-hmm. But I think also, I mean, we empathize with people, but we don't, like, truly know their thoughts, and we are selfish too, so I think it is a two-way thing, and it's, like, shown to be that way in this film. Mm-hmm.
Showing that little backstory about why Elizabeth is maybe silent because of the horrors of war and makes me think she's real. Because here's why she's being silent, because she was she's just shocked by society.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or maybe, I kept thinking maybe she's just an idealized person. That's why Alma thinks that she's gone crazy, or why she's gone mute. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, she is someone who's that selfless, who's just, who can't handle, you know, monks setting themselves on fire. You know, it's, she's taken a stand against fascism.
Yeah.
And, like, Alma's hero, that persona would, her ideal persona would go mute because of these horrible things. Mm. But I also thought, as I was watching, that it seemed to me that Alma wanted to embody this Elizabeth character. She wanted adventure. She longed for adventure. She was marrying someone she didn't love and was ultimately settling in her life. And Elizabeth represented something more glamorous.
An escape.
An escape, exactly. And while there is the symbolism of Alma asking Elizabeth to, like, drink her blood, it does imply, like, this vampiric sort of parasitic.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But it seemed to me that Alma was still, she was asking to be consumed. She wanted to be consumed in someone else's life to a certain extent. So.
Yeah. Or was that a dream? And, well, but I guess if it's a dream, it could still be what she wanted.
Right, yeah. It did feel like a kind of a fever dream, that whole second act, where I remember, like, the film burns up in the projector. It felt like from then on, everything that was happening seemed like it was in someone's, it was, again, a warped fever dream. I guess we don't really know.
That was amazing, by the way, the film breaking. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't imagine in the theater what you would have, at that time in 1966, you would have been like, hey, wait, whoa.
Yeah.
Is this... that's like breaking the fourth wall, kind of, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, even though the question of what's really happening and not really happening does play into the story in this movie, I kind of felt like it reminded me of, like, a Kubrick movie, like, especially of, like, 2001, where, like, how things are shown literally and metaphorically, and then, like, but they're presented, like, together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's like, on one hand, I was trying to figure out what was really happening, but on the other hand, I was like, it doesn't really matter because the, you know, message is still coming across, even if.
Right, yeah.
And I have to pick it apart and, like.
As a literalist sometimes myself, I get bogged down in that, and I should maybe take a step back. Maybe all viewers should, and just say, and maybe more people would enjoy this movie if they could just see it as, like you said, an experience.
I think it depends on the movie too. Like if something like this happened in like a Star Trek movie, like I would be outraged.
Yeah, yeah. that's another.
Maybe
episode.
They should try that.
Like if he was really asleep, then how could he have been talking? Yeah,
that's the whole holodeck, isn't it? Okay, this is a different podcast episode.
But did you guys find that you could relate to either character?
I thought. Both.
Yeah. I was a little concerned by how strongly I related to Alma.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So, like, she's unhappy in her life, and she creates this... This is my interpretation. She creates this image of this perfect woman who she can talk to at length about her problems and make them seem... Make all the things she feels guilty about seem okay. She can unburden herself, and then... She can then sort of become, she can let herself become this other person. And the sort of the fragile psyche, I guess I found myself relating to that, which is concerning a little bit.
I think probably everyone has some moment in their life where they feel like her, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's comforting. How about you, Andy?
I had a hard time relating to the people, but I understood them. I think it's more a female-centric story, and so that's why I had a hard time relating specifically. But I understood where they're coming from.
All right. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about how exactly the transfer of personalities is depicted. We can talk about Bergman's cinematography, and Emma, did you have any shots or anything that you wanted to point out?
Well, I'm sure everyone who's seen this movie remembers all the shots where there are two faces imposed over each other.
Yes. Oh. There's a very famous split screen, and the two actresses look eerily similar.
Yeah.
And also, when I think of Bergman films and Bergman cinematography, I always think of profile shots, or one person in profile, one person head on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That, and also ABBA music videos. Yeah. But
going deep.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's interesting how, like, it, obviously the symbolism, you're half a person, you only see half of the face. That's, and a persona, the title persona, that's, a persona can be an affectation, it can be just a part of yourself that you want to show people. So it's sort of like half of your,
like,
yourself.
You're concealing half.
Exactly. You're also concealing half. Precisely. I don't know. I don't know if there's an answer for this. There probably is. But what do you think it was important that she stopped speaking during a performance of Elektra?
It felt important, but I can't even though I had to read it like 5 times in high school, I cannot totally recall all the events of Elektra and why that might be significant.
Elektra is like, you think of Elektra complex, like as in Oedipal, where it was, I think Elektra wanted to kill her mother.
That's right.
Yeah, with her brother. So that's an Elektra complex.
That's right.
Now, you know. So, but Andy, you didn't think of that. Did that have any significance for you?
Well, I'm sure when I heard that it was Elektra and they did name it, I was like, oh, there must be a reason for that.
Yeah.
I know enough about film to know there must be a reason.
Yeah.
But I don't know the story of Elektra besides, I think, Jennifer Garner was in Elektra movie thing, but I didn't even watch that. But
I think that's unrelated, but
but this is a perfect example of a time when after the movie's over, you research and you think about this movie, and now you want to see Elektra.
Yeah.
Or read it, or whatever.
True. Or like
not the Jennifer Garner movie.
No.
Don't do that. Yeah, someone, I think I read, someone suggested that the little boy in the movie might have an Elektra complex, or something. I don't know. It was very deliberate. They pointed it out, but I couldn't quite figure out what that meant.
Wouldn't it be an Oedipal complex?
Wouldn't that be an Oedipal complex,
yeah.
Right?
I think the distinction is like from Freud and not from Greek tragedy, though. So.
Right, yeah.
I don't know why, but like whenever there's like a young boy in a movie, I always assume it has something to do with like a son and a mother. I don't know if that's just...
Well, I think Bergman had mommy, just parental issues. So, and I think
the boy may have been a representation of himself. It might be kind of autobiographical, and the Elizabeth figure might possibly have been his mother, who was sort of withdrawn for most of his life, emotionally withdrawn. So that might have been part of why he made her mute. But yeah, there's a lot to unpack in this movie, and I'm still grappling with it. I don't know. I'm not sure I quite understand it. I really like it, and I was very disturbed by it. And I'm still trying to figure out why. Because there's certainly more violent films in Bergman's repertoire, but this one I found it very disturbing. Mm-hmm. In a good way.
Yeah, it really keeps you thinking.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also really stylish. It's just so beautifully composed. When I think of Bergman movies, I think of women with illness, and mm-hmm. the shots in this movie is sort of when I think of the style of Bergman, I think of this movie. Maybe it may not embody all of his themes, but this seems to be like the pinnacle of that Bergman style, the quintessential Bergman mm-hmm. style. So, yeah.
Can we talk about a minute about the graphic nature of her story?
Well, I think we should. Sure, yeah.
I mean, I was blown away that this was 1966 and this was being recorded for a film. Sweden is historically, I think, different that way. But I don't know. I was just amazed. Yeah. And I don't know how this was received in the United States. I didn't, after I watched the film, I read some stuff. I didn't see anything about, I think there was a comment about one of the releases they had to edit. Or, oh, you know what I read? I read that this latest closed captioning, they had people who were...
like they're the people doing the subtitles?
Yes. The subtitle people were like... self-editing or not self-editing. They were editing the movie because it was so graphic. And they actually had someone or a group of people, whoever, translate more literally what she was saying.
Wow. So do we know if maybe we got the real interpretation?
In 66, they were getting a real watered-down version.
Yeah.
And this, I mean, I was...
1966. Yeah.
I would think they might, nowadays, if they were to shoot that... they would put it in almost like a flashback thing. It would be less graphic to film it
than to have her talk. That's true.
Than
yeah.
to talk about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. there's something more personal about her telling the story than had they shown it. That's true. I'm trying to think of other movies that came out in 1966. And as far as I can recall, I don't know if there's probably some Fellini movie that was probably just as explicit, mm-hmm. but I imagine it would have been shocking, especially to an American audience, even if it was a very cultured, you know, metropolitan mm-hmm. audience. It's still shocking to this day.
Yes.
But it's the tone of it too. Like there's so much shame in her when she's telling the story. Like that's, I think, what makes it so disturbing. Because otherwise, it sounds like she had a great day on the beach.
I know.
Wow. Is that I got to go to different beaches. Iggy Pop had a line that I love, and one of his songs from the late 70s. I wish life could be more like Swedish magazines.
Ah, yes.
It all makes sense.
Yes.
Weren't a lot of pornographic movies imported from Sweden?
Well, there's that movie I Am Yellow, which I believe is somewhere. It was made somewhere in Scandinavia. I think it might have been Swedish, and that caused quite a stir. Okay, anything else? Or should we just end it on porn? Okay, so one final question, guys. So this is the number 17 movie on the Sight and Sound poll. Do we feel it is worthy of the number 17 spot? Emma, let's start with you. What do you think?
Well, as usual, I liked this movie, and I think it could go up a couple notches if we got rid of rules of the game.
And indeed.
That's probably...
I'm there with you.
But no, yeah, I like this movie a lot.
Okay. Andy, how about you?
Any movie that makes you think is a great movie.
All right.
Cool. This was very well done.
Yeah. I agree with both of you. I say move it up a couple notches. Yeah. I feel like this is top notch. Like, this one is going to kind of blow your mind a little bit. You will be left with more questions than answers. And if that bothers you, then you might not like the movie. But I think that there is something in this movie that everyone can at least appreciate. So, yeah.
People who only watch stuff like Jennifer Garner's Elektra need to see something like this and just realize what film has to offer.
Yeah. I don't think it would be boring either to someone who likes, comic book movies.
Exactly. No, it's really cool, guys. You should watch it. Let's move on to a film with a slightly more optimistic look on humanity. For our second topic, we're going to discuss Richard Linklater's 2014 feature film, Boyhood. In addition to getting rave reviews, Boyhood's also been getting a lot of attention because of the unique circumstances of its production. The film was shot over the course of 12 years. Once a year, Linklater would bring his cast together for a few weeks to shoot a new sequence of the movie. The finished film plays like the most ambitious home video ever laid to tape, as we watch the real-life human actors grow and age instantaneously on screen. The condensing of time makes the characters in the film feel real. However, this is not a documentary. This is the fictional story of a young man named Mason Jr., played by A.L.R. Coltrane, whom we get to watch grow from cherubic pre-adolescent boy to moody withdrawn teenager, and eventually into a thoughtful, bright young man. We see how mundane benchmarks of time affect Mason. We see how his relationship with his divorced parents, played by Patricia Arquette and Ethan Hawke, change. We watch him fall in and out of love, and eventually we watch him transition from boyhood into adulthood. So Andy hasn't yet seen this movie, but he's going to jump in with questions.
If I can. Yeah, I love Linklater, so I look forward to seeing this.
All right. But we're going to go ahead and spoil it for you a little bit.
All right.
He's an alien.
All right, Emma. Didn't see that one coming, huh? What did you think of the movie?
I loved the movie.
Yeah. So what did you like about it?
I kind of liked feeling a little bit nostalgic for stuff that, even though it didn't really happen that long ago, I liked all the characters except for like string of drunk husbands, obviously. I don't know, it just made me feel good to watch. Like, it's a life not unlike mine. It's a pretty normal story.
Yeah,
but it's, I don't know, something felt like really beautiful about it.
Yeah, I'm not a parent, and I have no idea what it's like to be a parent, but watching this film is probably the closest I've felt towards that. Like, I felt very parental towards this kid, and the way watching him age made me feel very protective of him, and I felt this really like deep sadness watching him age, but also this pride because he was getting older and things were okay. And he was progressing normally, which made me really happy.
Yeah, like, he's like kind of a cool kid at the end of by the end of the movie.
Yeah,
and you're like,
look, you came out all right. Look at you. And I wanted to talk about how he does come out right. A series of really awful things happen to him, mm-hmm. or maybe not to him, but a series of awful things surrounds him. There's his mother, played by Patricia Arquette, marries a couple of dudes who are not so upstanding. They're kind of drunks, one of whom is pretty abusive. And it was heartwarming, and it was such a relief to find that Mason could survive that and could emerge as a normal kid. And hopefully he'll be okay. I'm talking about him like he's a real person because he does feel so real.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this movie, part of its hook, part of what's getting butts in the seats in the theater is the premise. While it's a really great idea, it's also kind of a gimmick to watch this person age in real time, essentially. Uh-huh. Or not in real time, but you're gonna actually literally watch this person age. But did you feel like that the story transcended the premise or the gimmick?
Well, for one, you're calling it a gimmick, but it's like, I felt it had the effect of being non-gimmicky, because it's like, it's essentially a period piece, but it doesn't have to be like super precious with like the production design and stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, it felt like the story felt like appropriate. Like it could have been like the, you know, time traveler's wife or something like that. Yeah. Like, but instead,
yeah,
it was about a kid growing up.
Yeah. But I mean, the actual, had the structure been different, had they just used different actors at each stage, do you think the story would have been as compelling?
No, I definitely got attached to all of the performers.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah. So one of the things that I loved about the movie was that it seemed to be about how mundane life can be and yet extraordinary. Mm-hmm. It seemed both mundane and extraordinary. Like, look, he's growing. It's happening. It's working. Yeah. But all he's doing is sitting there, you know, or he's drinking beer for the first time, or he's interacting with people like a human being, and it's working.
Yeah.
So that was one thing that I loved about the movie. And you do develop this attachment to this kid, and to all the people in the movie. Mm-hmm. And also, I really loved how it never turns into an after-school special.
Right.
Because it certainly could have. He's got this kind of, not troubled background, but less than ideal background. But he seems to turn out okay. And we watch him experiment with some drug use, some underage drinking, but nothing disastrous ever happens. Mm-hmm. He's still, in each phase of the movie, he emerges pretty unscathed.
Yeah.
You know, he just kind of goes with it.
I liked watching the parents, too. It's kind of cool. Like, when you're a kid, you don't really realize that your parents are also, like, growing up and, like, learning how to do what they do.
Yeah.
I liked watching that aspect of it a lot, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like we should talk about, especially, what did you think of the performances of Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette?
I liked him a lot.
Yeah.
I never thought Patricia Arquette, like, that I would see her being, like, so maternal. But she, like, really felt, like, so mom to me.
Yeah. I thought the Ethan Hawke character, that was so subtly done because he could be that cool dad figure.
Mm-hmm.
And the cool dad is kind of annoying because he can waltz in, take the kids out to a ball game, and have nothing else to do with him and, like, skip all the hard parts. And to a certain extent, he does that. But the film acknowledges that. And it also acknowledges that despite his limited presence in the kids' lives, he's still overall a very positive influence. And he's doing the right thing, ultimately.
Yeah.
Yeah, I liked the handling of that. And I thought, I don't know what it is about Ethan Hawke and Richard Linklater, but they just seem to work really well together.
Mm-hmm.
I like all of their collaborations. I mean, they've done, obviously, the Before series, and they did he was in Waking Life, now he's in this, and he just seems to be able to handle the Linklater way of making a movie really well.
Yeah, he seems like a normal dude.
Yeah. Which is surprising because a lot of people really don't like Ethan Hawke.
Huh.
Yeah.
Maybe because he's so good at playing everyday people? I don't know.
I think they had just like residual bad feelings towards him because of Reality Bites.
Uh huh.
Maybe.
That character is such a jerk, though.
What? He is. Ooh. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on Ethan Hawke, Andy?
I have some thoughts about Reality Bites.
Okay, let's hear them.
He was a jerk in that movie. Ethan Hawke, I think he does a great job in the Linklater films.
Okay.
I've seen nothing but talent there. And if you hate him because of Reality Bites, then he did his job. He was supposed to be kind of hated, right?
Yeah. I feel like a lot of big actors, like, don't necessarily pull that off either, that they can be a good jerk or a good normal guy.
Yeah. But she still does end up with him at the end of Reality Bites. So he was, like, this weird kind of jerk, but with a heart of gold, kind of, like, he's the misunderstood poet. Ugh.
Yeah, he was kind of a deadbeat character. Yeah. The character was.
It's kind of like Pretty in Pink, like, where it's, like, she's torn between two guys, but both options, like, kind of suck.
Yeah.
And nobody likes the ending.
Yeah. Well, I guess in Reality Bites, she goes with the opposite direction. Oh, my God. I feel like Reality Bites was trying to
they like wanted to redo Pretty in Pink with the correct guy getting her at the end.
Oh, wow.
But everyone got mad at that too, so you just can't win.
Maybe the girl should just be a self-realized individual at the end of the movie.
Exactly. How about that?
She should have started dating the girl who worked at Gap.
Janine Garofalo.
Yeah. That would have been the best.
So the movie's called Boyhood, but I feel like it's about more than just being a boy and growing up a boy. What else did you think the movie was about?
It felt a lot about the whole family to me. Like, family was definitely the center of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, there's other stuff, like, you know, like education and stuff like that in it, but they're kind of, like, on the side.
Yeah. It seemed to me more about, because it could have just as easily have been the Lorelai Linklater's story, the little girl, mm-hmm. but they instead focused on, it is from the boy's, I don't even want to say it, it wasn't even from his point of view until the end, but at the beginning of the movie, it really does feel like it is about this family and the dynamic within this family more than just on Mason,
mm-hmm.
And I just thought it was a great depiction of what it's like to try and raise a child, one, in this economy, and two, in a family where you're a single parent,
mm-hmm.
and the realities of that. So, and I think, again, Patricia Arquette did a great job. One of the things that I also loved about the movie were all the little cultural touchstones where you can sort of, like, anchor yourself, like, uh-huh. in time because of the cultural references that they like smatter throughout the whole thing.
Right. I wonder if they like shot a lot of stuff that they didn't use because it ended up not being as memorable as right. it seemed like it would be like, oh man, how about those American Idol results?
Right. Yeah. Like yeah. Well, apparently they just sort of crashed that Harry Potter book signing thing.
Yeah.
So that was really happening. They had to go out of their way to go get that filmed. But that it all, even if it doesn't feel as resonant today, or if it's things aren't as culturally significant,
mm-hmm.
I still like. I felt kind of nostalgic watching all these things, but more than that, it sort of anchored me in time. Like, okay, mm-hmm. here we are now. Because as you said, it is kind of a period piece. They just happened to have filmed it when it was actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a really good way of looking at it. I thought. You know, it was great to go back and watch Will Ferrell yelling at his niece.
Oh, my gosh. And I know that's a thing of the past now, too, because I went to a family event last night, and my cousin, who is 17, had no idea about Pearl the Landlord. He was telling me he's, like, the biggest Will Ferrell fan. He had not even seen Pearl the Landlord.
Well, I assume you set him straight.
I hope he looked it up on his fancy smartphone.
You know, it's funny you guys bring that up. I was gonna ask if there was, like, a... Hey, look, it's 2006.
Yeah.
Here are Pogs or whatever.
Exactly.
Pogs are 90s, you know what I mean? Like, so there was moments. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it didn't feel like it felt, it was subtly done.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
I believed it. And I also think it's important to include things like that because I think a huge part of growing up is the cultural things that you like. The music you listen to and the movies you watch and the TV you consume, these are all huge parts of childhood and adolescence. They play a huge role in shaping your identity. Like, I don't know, maybe if they don't shape your identity, then it just becomes a signifier of who you are, is what you listen to and what you like,
mm-hmm.
especially when you're that age. So I thought it was really well done. Plus, I just liked going back and, you know, watching that little girl sing along to Britney Spears. That was adorable. That was so darling. And then she watches the telephone video on her smartphone. Mm-hmm. It was like, that's totally a thing you would have done in that year.
That's the other thing, too. It's like, you know, like historically significant stuff is happening during the movie. Like the war in Iraq is happening during the movie. And because they shot it at the time, it's like people are acting like they did then. Like they're not like putting people through like the filter of hindsight, You know, like when you watch like Mad Men and you're like, was everyone in this office really that racially tolerant?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's a really good point. That is how these people felt about the war at that time. Mm-hmm. And that does feel way more authentic. It's because it's not a recreation. This is actually what happened. So that's a very good point, Emma. So I want to just go ahead and talk about Richard Linklater, because a lot of people, as we discussed on our Dazed and Confused podcast, which listeners can go back on our website and they can go on iTunes and listen, all three of us had a discussion about Dazed and Confused. And we talked about how Richard Linklater sometimes gets criticized for not having, I guess he doesn't have a distinct visual style. Some people have accused him. And we all sort of disagreed and, you know, established that he's really has these gorgeous long takes. That's really his trademark.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if there were any visual sequences in this movie that really struck you.
I thought a lot of the nature scenes at the end when he's off to college were, like, super beautiful.
Yeah.
There actually were a lot of cool nature scenes.
Yeah, he goes camping. Yeah. Like, it's all very understated.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. And I always get a little sad when I hear people criticize Linklater for the lack of visual panache.
Well, he also made two, like, super psychedelic rotoscoped movies, animated movies.
Right, exactly. It doesn't get much more stylish than that. Yeah. That's true. But also, he may not have the sparkle of, like, a Paul Thomas Anderson or something, mm-hmm. but I think his movies are just as ambitious.
Yeah.
And I don't think he gets enough credit for that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously he's getting a lot of credit for this, but even still, like, given the monumental achievement that is this film, he's still getting crap for not having a good enough visual sense. And that just feels to me like it's completely, you're missing the point, first of all, because it's not boring to look at. It's very engaging, but it's just very subtle.
Yeah.
And I think his style perfectly suits the subject matter. And I'm just going to go ahead and close by saying that I think Richard Linklater is one of the most ambitious filmmakers of our time. And I feel like he doesn't get enough credit because his movies are so approachable.
Mm-hmm.
They're so, anyone can watch them and see the appeal. But when you think about it, they're kind of astounding what he's put to film. I mean, it's such an incredible body of work he has.
They always have, like, such large, like, ensemble casts. There's always a lot of, like, really well-developed, like, interesting characters.
Just two people.
Right. Three people stuck in a hotel room.
Right. he's not a Malick. You know, he's not waiting until 5 p.m. for magic hour so he can shoot one shot.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about that. It's about establishing the relationships between the characters and like filming them, even if it's a beautiful locales a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he captures moments. I think that's what he excels at.
Yeah.
And his films have this improvised feel that other filmmakers can't touch at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so stop saying that, people. He's great.
Something about his style seems very memory driven too. Like, P.T. Anderson is like manipulating the way things look to have like a certain like dramatic effect and like to make you feel like this other like metaphorical level of what's happening. But I think Richard Linklater, you always feel like this is like something that you witnessed and recall, and that's the way it seemed at the time.
So, in short, go see Boyhood. It's really good.
I will.
Yeah, Mandy. Get on that. Okay. All right, let's close this thing out on a positive note. Emma, what's one movie, song, television show, piece of pop culture, ephemera, etc., that you are feeling positive about?
Well, I hate to sound like a spokesperson, but I got a Fitbit recently, and I am freaking obsessed with it. I love it so much, and I am, I think, a lot more active than I was before. Like, there's been a lot of days where I was going to sit on the couch and decided not to.
All right. Well, tell us what a Fitbit is.
It is a very popular activity tracking device. You can get one that clips on your belt, I believe, or I have one that's a little wristband, and it syncs up with your, you know, smart device. It gives you a little profile on the internet. It tracks how many steps you took. It estimates how many calories you burned. It tells you the distance you went. And you can also, like, log food that you eat with it.
So all right. So that weirdo marching in place, that's Emma.
Yeah. David Sedaris wrote an article about having one for the New Yorker. Mm-hmm. I think he said he ended up walking, like, 9 miles a day. He hasn't given it up yet. He's, like, cleaned up the little town in England that he lives in. Like, he's, like, picking up trash and, like, walking around all day.
All right, Andy, how about you? What's your final note of positivity?
Well, I've been getting back into music lately, and there's this band out of Austin called the Ghost Wolves. And what you guys need to do is go out to YouTube and watch a video called Gonna Live by the Ghost Wolves. And this video is DIY, it's lo-fi. They start out driving in a car. They're playing the drums on the steering wheel. She's playing a guitar. It's all recorded. She's singing. It's all recorded right into a lavalier mic. And as a sound guy, it's really cool to see this one-shot video that takes us on a little drive into a home where she's playing the whole song unbroken, and it joins into a nice little jam in the house. And it's a joyous video. It's a fun video. The Ghost Wolves sound like the White Stripes mixed with the Kills and with a female singer.
Yeah, that sounds good. We'll have to link that in the show page.
Oh, good idea.
Yeah. Mine is not a TV show for a change. I as promised, I am bringing a book for my final note of positivity.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I read. Yeah. But my book is The Good Lord Bird by James McBride. It was the 2013 National Book Award winner. But as we know, I'm busy watching television shows primarily, so it took me a year to read this. But but the book tells the story of the John Brown Rebellion from the point of view of a young man named Henry Shackelford, who was liberated from slavery by John Brown. And he travels around Kansas with Brown and basically all over the country trying to initially drum up support for the rebellion. And then we actually get to see the rebellion from this kid's point of view. And there have been several novelizations of the Brown rebellion and the Brown figure.
Mm-hmm.
And he remains to this day pretty controversial. I don't know exactly where historians stand on him. Obviously very complicated, but very, very significant figure in American history.
Mm-hmm.
But this book has a very interesting take, a unique take on him. It's very irreverent, and I've heard it compared to Mark Twain, which seems apt. It's got a very similar, no, I mean, they both use dialects, and they both have quite a way with words. They use dialects to similar effect. And the overall tone does feel very similar to something like The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. And if that's not a ringing endorsement, I don't know what is. And also, it's worth it just for the scene with Frederick Douglass alone. That one is not to be missed. So, again, highly recommend it. It's called The Good Lord Bird by James McBride.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right.
And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Did watching Persona leave you a shell of your former self? No, that was just me. Okay. Well, come tell me what a weirdo I am on our show page, flickswise.com. Come like us on Facebook at facebook.com/flickswise. You can even follow us on Twitter at flickswise. But again, if you do nothing else, please subscribe and rate us on iTunes. On the next episode, we're going to talk about the movie that's tied with Persona for the number 17 spot on the Sight and Sound poll, Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. Until then, Emma and Andy, thank you so much for talking about Bergman and Linkletter with me, and we'll have to have you guys back on again soon. Guys? Not again.